This is the 19th chapter. This chapter is one of the saddest chapters in all of the Bible. In terms of the description it supplies to us, not only of the wicked, but also of a man of God. We'll begin reading together at verse 1, and we'll read down through verse 29. Genesis chapter 19, verses 1 through 29. And there came two angels to Sodom at evening. And Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them. And he bowed himself with his face toward the ground and said, "Behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go on your ways." And they said, "Nay, but we will abide in the street all night." And he pressed upon them greatly, and they turned in unto him and entered into his house. He made them a feast, and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot, and said unto him, "Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them." And Lot went out at the door unto them, and shut the door after him, and said, "I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you. And do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing. For therefore came they under the shadow of my roof." And they said, "Stand back." And they said again, "This one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them." And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them and shut the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. And the men said unto Lot, "Hast thou here any beside, son-in-law, and thy sons, and thy daughters, and whatsoever thou hast in the city? Bring them out of this place. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord. And the Lord has sent us to destroy it." And Lot went out and spoke unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, "Up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, "Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city." And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, "Escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed." And Lot said unto them, "Oh, not so, my lord. Behold now, thy servant hath found grace in thy sight. Thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape into the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Behold now, this city is near to me. Behold now, this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said unto him, See, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow this city for the which thou hast spoken. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come hither. Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain. And beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt. Now in this dreadful passage that is before us tonight, we have the record of God turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemning them with an overthrow, making them an example to those that should after live ungodly, while delivering just Lot out of that condemnation, as 2 Peter 2, verses 6 and 7 tell us. Now, there are a great many lessons contained in this passage, but there are three in particular that I want to draw your attention to by way of introduction this evening. The first lesson this passage tells us is that it tells us of the extent of the evil homosexuality and homosexuals will engage in if they are left unchecked. Homosexuals are not, nor have they ever been, nor will they ever be, those who will quietly live and let live. The wickedness of this sin is unbounded and eventually throws off every restraint, so that it demands everyone to participate in or actively assist in its abominable practices and perversions. Homosexuality is a behavior that consumes all that are given over to it and all that are affected by it in a pursuit of death, a death that is both personal and a death that is also societal. Now, this passage stands as a beacon to remind us that either we destroy the homosexual movement, the homosexual culture, and the homosexual influence in our government and society, or else it will destroy both us and our families. And there can be no neutrality in this war. Secondly, this passage also tells us of the dangers of exposing ourselves and our families to a degenerate culture. Now, Lot lost his testimony, he lost his influence, and he lost his family, and he lost all of his possessions because of living and because of his insistence upon living in the midst of wickedness instead of separating from it. It is a simple fact that one cannot continuously expose his wife and his children to worldliness and expect them to turn out well. We must, as 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17 says, come out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing. Evil companions and evil influences corrupt the best of morals, and we must not be companions of fools if we hope to avoid suffering their destruction ourselves. And so there is a great danger of exposing ourselves and our families to a degenerate culture through television, through public schools, through movies, through magazines, through books, through associations with ungodly people. We as Christians must separate ourselves from these things, or we as Christians will be overwhelmed by these things. The third lesson that is contained in this passage is this passage makes it clear that God will not tolerate blatant evil forever. These cities were noted by God. These cities were condemned by God. And these cities were overthrown by God because these cities chose to defy God, to defy Him continuously, to defy Him openly, to defy Him blatantly, to defy Him shamelessly. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a people in society shall sow, that shall they also reap. He that sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, be it individual or be it societal. God, it is true, is patient and long-suffering. But He will not be ignored, nor will He be rejected with impunity forever. And when the day of His wrath comes, who shall be able to stand? Such a passage as this should cause us to fear for ourselves, and to fear for others, and to fear before God, and take actions against such sins in society and in ourselves, lest we too become the objects of God's wrath. And though God shows mercy to Lot and saves him alive, what horrible loss he incurred because of his compromise with the world and because of his involvement with it. He lost his family. He lost his possessions. He lost his influence. He lost his reputation and was reduced from the pinnacle of wealth to the pinnacle of shame because of his choice to abandon the company of the godly in order to live among the wicked. Well, let us then, viewing this passage, make the choice that Moses made, who chose to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season by having respect unto the recompense of the reward. Had Lot chosen to stay with Abraham, he would have never suffered any of this. But instead, rather than to suffer affliction with the people of God for a season, he chose to enjoy the pleasures of sin. And we see where those choices led him. Well, what we want to do then this evening is to consider the contents and lessons of this passage. In the first place, let us consider together the appearance of the angels at Sodom. The appearance of the angels at Sodom. Now, this is contained in verses 1 through 3, which I have already read to you. There came the two angels to Sodom at evening. Now, these two angels were the same two who, along with Christ, had appeared to Abraham in chapter 18, the previous chapter. And they came in fulfillment of chapter 18, verses 20 through 22, when the Lord said, "Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know." And so the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom. Well, they have arrived. And as they come into the gate of the city, who is in the gate of the city but Lot? By this time, Lot was thoroughly immersed in the current of Sodom's life and Sodom's activity. Notice his progress, or we should say his degeneration in this matter. Back in chapter 13, verses 7 through 13, we are told that even though the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly, Lot pitched his tent towards Sodom when he separated from Abraham. And so we see that when he left Abraham, the man of God, and the company of the people of God, he began to move towards the company of the people of the world. Then by chapter 14 and verse 12, we see that Lot dwelt in Sodom. And of course, as a result, he was captured along with all the rest of the Sodomites by the kings from the east, and he was taken away captive. And you remember that Abraham, with his 318 servants, went and rescued him and all the people of Sodom and all the goods and delivered them all back to the king of Sodom. Lot, not having learned his lesson from that temporal judgment of God upon these people, continued to dwell in Sodom, and by chapter 19 and verse 1, Lot is sitting in the gate. Now, to sit in the gate was to be in a position of complete involvement in the affairs, in the activities, and in the government of the city. In fact, let me just read you a little section out of Leopold's commentary on this chapter on page 555 and page 556, when he says this: "The gate of the city where Lot is at the time is the common resort of all men, especially of the elders of a city. Their legal matters are adjudicated, transactions closed, bargains made, and affairs discussed. Lot's presence here will hardly be accounted for on the assumption that he was on the lookout for guests. Rather, Lot's presence in the gate constitutes a reproach to the man. After having first moved down into the plain of Sodom, he presently chose Sodom itself as his dwelling place, and now finally he has arrived at the point where the activities, the bustle and stir are looked upon with a more or less tolerant interest." And so Lot is now fully integrated into the life and worldliness of this depraved and wretched city. We are told in the book of 2 Peter that his righteous soul was vexed with the deeds of the wicked, but apparently it wasn't vexed enough in order to move out of the place. There was an attitude of tolerance where there should have been a fleeing away. Now, it must be said, however, that Lot was one who was not all bad. He was one who was hospitable to strangers and generous with his possessions. And so in verses 1 through 3, we see that when these angels came, he took the initiative to meet them, invite them into his home. And when they initially refused out of politeness, he pressed them greatly, and they came into his house, and he fed them a meal. Now, as these men approached the gate of the city, there was obviously something in their appearance that moved Lot to recognize these men as worthy of his hospitality. They were obviously not wicked men, but men of honor. And how did he know this? Well, I would suggest, no doubt, partly by their appearance. They were probably not tattooed, pierced, dressed like they had just crawled out of a dumpster, effeminate in their manner, or obnoxious in their carriage. The way a person simply dresses himself and the appearance that they present says a great deal about their character. There was a nobility not only about their appearance, but also about their bearing and manner, so that Lot instantly recognized them as honorable men, sought to shelter them from the evil of the city and the people in it. Now, knowing the rest of the story, imagine how these men would have fared had they spent the night in the streets. So for all his failings and folly, Lot had at least learned the grace of hospitality from Abraham. He had some desire to associate with decent folk, and his conduct in this matter was commendable. And so he provided them with both food and shelter. Verse 3. And so, having then seen the appearance of the angels, in the second place, let us consider together the attack upon the angels. the attack upon the angels. Now, the attack upon the angels is one of the most awful descriptions of the depths to which human depravity can descend that is given to us anywhere in the Scriptures. Here in verses 4 through 11 is a vivid description of the attitude and the effect of homosexuality upon the human heart. Verse 4. But before they lay down, that is, Lot and his guests and his family, before they went to bed that night, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. And so the attitude and effect of homosexuality upon the human heart is here described. Homosexuality is the most vicious of all sins because it produces the most depraved of all behaviors. These men are determined to brazenly commit homosexual rape upon these two men who have come into their city. First of all, notice the participants. Verse 4. It says, The men of the city, even the men of Sodom, both young and old, and all the people from every quarter. This was the participants in this activity. And so what we see here is that they were men, both old and young. The young, of course, had been converted to this and recruited into it by the older. Because homosexuals are made, they are not born, and they must be recruited into the death style which they follow. We see this in our day. We see the homosexual community constantly seeking to insert themselves into the youth programs of our culture. They want to get into the public schools. And they want to have homosexual teachers and counselors, and they have succeeded in achieving that in a great many school districts. They have programs like Project 10 and movies like It's a Family that are designed to desensitize children to homosexuality and its horror, first of all, and then secondly, to entice and recruit them into it. And then, of course, we have seen the effort to invade the Boy Scouts. Thus far, unsuccessfully, thank God, but the Girl Scouts and the Big Brothers and Sisters organization have welcomed them with open arms so that the leadership of these organizations is now permeated with homosexuals. And so they go after the youth in order to recruit them because, of course, they cannot reproduce. Now, as a small illustration of this, I have a poster that I acquired during the Measure 9 campaign that was passed out at the schools. It has a picture of a clown on it. This is obviously oriented towards elementary school children. Hey kids, if you were a boy, have you ever had strong feelings for another boy? Or if you were a girl, have you ever had strong feelings for another girl? Well, if you have, then that's homosexuality. And you know what? It's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. Tell your mom and dad that you don't mind hearing about gays and lesbians at school because you have them in every class. There is something called Measure 9, this election. If it passes, gays and lesbians could be hurt, even killed, maybe even you. Tell your parents to vote no on Measure 9. Tell them that if they don't, they are full of hate, and we don't want that. No on 9. Passed out at the public schools. The point is, all the people from every quarter, this vice had seized upon the population in general because once it is tolerated, it spreads rapidly to infect the entire culture at every level, both young and old, people from every quarter of life. But having seen the participants, notice secondly the techniques. Now, with reference to their techniques, these men are utterly shameless and brazen. In verse 5, they make no bones about what their intentions are. Where are the men? Bring them out that we may know them. No shame, just brazen, bold, wicked demands. In Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, this attitude is described, in which it says, "Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush." And what is amazing is how the homosexual community at their riots and demonstrations will address the righteous as they attempt to speak before a city council and will say to them, "Shame, shame, shame." The homosexual is putting shame upon the righteous, when in fact they are the people that ought to be ashamed but have none. And so what we see in this passage in Genesis 19 is these men are not content to practice their wickedness merely among themselves. They demand that all people participate with them, or else actively assist and facilitate them in their abominations. And this is what they were demanding of Lot. They were saying, "You need to assist us in the prosecution of our abominations." Now, a lot of people think, "Well, Pastor, what are you getting so worked up over homosexuality for? You know, you need to just live and let live." Well, I want to tell you something. These people will not let live. I remember when I was involved in the Measure 9 campaign and the Measure 13 campaign, that one of the things the newspaper editor in Albany said is, "Why don't you leave these poor people alone?" And I wrote back a guest editorial and I said to him, "Because they won't leave us alone. They want our children. They want to force themselves upon us in the workplace and in the churches and in every institution and circumstance." We cannot live and let live with reference to this vice, because these people will not do so. Just as here, they will not leave you alone. They want inside your home. They want inside your churches. They want inside your schools. They want inside your workplaces, and they want inside your mind. And they will not rest content until they have access to every one of those. They are utterly totalitarian and utterly ruthless and will accept no reproof, nor will they accept any compromise. Notice verses 6 through 9. Lot goes out at the door unto them and shut the door after them, and said, and he begins to plead with them, "I pray you, brethren," notice the term he used, brethren, "do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them what is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing. Therefore they came under the shadow of my roof, and they said, stand back. And they said again, this one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them." And you already know what they were going to do with them. "We will do worse with thee than with them." And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to smash down the door. Now, with reference to Lot's plea and offer of his daughters, there is utterly no excuse possible for this action on his part. And it shows how far he had descended into compromise with these people and accommodation with these people and giving these people their way in the hope that if he just gave in to them this one time, they would stop there and they wouldn't go any further. And I don't know what compromises he had made before, but he was ready to make this one, which tells us he had already compromised a long ways in a lot of areas, many times,
giving up ground until he's ready to give up his own daughters to these men. Now, there is utterly no excuse possible for this act on Lot's part. But this act on Lot's part is very instructive. Stopping a domestic partner's law in San Francisco, the homosexuals came and assaulted his church while he's having church. Let me read you a little description. For the next few weeks, things really heated up at the church. Picketers and reporters with TV crews plagued our Sunday morning services. The police were also there most of the time to keep order. Rent-a-mob was there. That's the name we've given to a group of people who attend every protest promoting immorality, whether it be for homosexuality, abortion, or anything else. There are people whose only conviction in life seems to be to attend any and all demonstrations and to be as civilly disobedient as possible. Demonstrators came inside during the service and attempted to disrupt my preaching. Some men were dressed in leather, while others had dresses on, complete with bows in their hair. Some were quite, quote, normal, unquote, looking by San Francisco standards. A few got up and walked around during the service. One man would open a window and then slam it shut repeatedly in order to disrupt the service. For the most part, the women were butch, masculine-looking, and tough. Since the front doors and windows of the church are flush up against the sidewalk, the protesting outside got full play on the inside also. They perform mock same-sex marriages in front of the church. Some of the women lay down on the sidewalk, and chalk was used to outline them as though marking the spot where a dead body had fallen. They had red paint splattered on their clothing, referencing blood. They held coat hangers in their hands folded across their chests. This, of course, was to protest our stand against abortion. They sang raucous songs mocking the Christian faith, the church, and the family. This was a real gay rights evangelistic meeting. They even came prepared with song sheets. One lesbian in particular, who goes from protest to protest, made herself particularly obnoxious with her jeering, mocking songs. She led the congregation in singing some of the following, and I'll not bother to read the words to you. Copies of these songs were strewn around the neighborhood, and some were left in the sanctuary during the service. In the upper right-hand corner of the sheet was a skeletal form, holding a cross in its left hand and a skull in its right. A picture of my head, taken from a local newspaper article, was superimposed on top of the skeletal form. Next to my face it said, Reverend Charles McElhaney, with Save the City from Sin coming out of my mouth. During the service, policemen stood shoulder to shoulder across the front doorway, and a couple of officers stationed themselves in the landing of the stairs going up into the auditorium. The next time you're tempted to complain that perhaps your worship service seems a little boring, don't. Now get this, and this is my point. As the people in our congregation left the church that morning, the protesters stood at the entrance and or followed the Christians to their cars, pointing their fingers and yelling in our faces, shame, shame, shame. Police officers in squad cars and on motorcycles lined the block. They were there to protect the protesters' right to harass. Donna overheard one officer say to another, "We're here to protect the right of these protesters against those church people." Where were the cops in Genesis 19? I'll tell you where they were, protecting the homosexuals. In case Lot might hurt them. These people, we have to understand, are ruthless, they are vicious, they are utterly without morals of any kind and will engage in any wickedness imaginable, even if they believe it necessary to achieve their goals. If they believe it necessary to achieve their goals, they will use murder, arson, vandalism, intimidation, obscene phone calls, riots, harassment, assault. These are all the stock in trade of the homosexual movement. And if you doubt that, just simply read the book. It's all there. A description of the takeover of San Francisco from start to finish by the gay community. Now, with reference to their violence, their threats of murder and arson and vandalism and intimidation and obscene phone calls and riots and harassment and assaults, I have a couple of posters put out by the homosexual community and stuck up around Portland. This one says, "Civil rights or civil war, your choice for a limited time only. Vote no on 9. This one has a picture of a fish roasting over a fire. Fish, of course, is the Christian symbol. It says, "You burn us, we burn you." In other words, if this passes, we're going to start in on you. This one says, "Vote no on 9 or we shoot the fish." We're not asking you, we're telling you. This one says, "Queer knives, queer guns, queer bullets, queer missiles, queer tanks, queer trenches, queer fire, queer warfare, queer patriots. No on 9's a good idea." Sodom exists not only in San Francisco, but in Portland as well. What we are reading here in Genesis 19 is exactly what has already occurred and is occurring right now in the major centers of homosexuality in Seattle, in Portland, in San Francisco, in New York City. These people will accept no peaceful coexistence between themselves and Christians who offer any reproof of their behavior, as did Lot. Notice what they said in verse 9. "Stand back. This one fellow came to sojourn. He will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee and with them." And they pressed sore upon the man and came near to break down the door. And what they're saying in essence to Lot is this: you have the nerve to reprove us for wanting to commit homosexual gang rape? Who do you think you are? We will deal worse with you than with these men that we want to rape. And his courtesy to them in verse 7, "I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly," was met with hatred. His reproof of their wrongdoing was met with violence. And when he offered them even the most debauched form of heterosexual alternative, they determined to kill him. Even though Lot was the man who caused Abraham to go and rescue all the people in this city from the 5 kings of the east, or 4, I think there were. You remember, they were all going to go into slavery, and Abraham came and rescued them all for Lot's sake. And you would think they would be grateful to Lot for the fact that their city was delivered, but do they remember? Not a chance. Listen, the homosexual community is not playing games. If you oppose them, they will try to silence you any way they can. And if you retreat into passivity, then they will leave you alone, but they will insist on having your children right out of your own house. And they will insist that you facilitate the process under the threat of law. That's where they're headed. People say, "Well, you know, Pastor, if we rise up and fight these people politically, they'll come after us." Well, if you don't, they're going to come after you anyway. And when they finally do, they'll come after you with the civil authorities at their back, which is precisely what happened in the passage. And what chance will you have then? Better to fight now, while there's some hope of success, than to wait until they have completely co-opted all of the legislative processes and all of the police enforcement powers to back up their perverted demands. Appeasement and accommodation and inactivity is the road to self-destruction. And if we take it one day, they will be beating down our walls and our doors as well. Pretty grim. But there's hope in all of this. And that is that the wicked will be judged by God, and the believers will be protected by God. And that leads us to our third point this evening. Having seen the appearance of the angels, having seen the attack upon the angels, in the third and final place, let us consider together the annihilation by the angels. The annihilation by the angels. And this is in verses 10 through 29. Now, Lot did a lot of things wrong, but he did do a few things right. He showed hospitality to the angels, and he reproved the rapists for their intended actions. First of all, then, notice that Lot was protected, verses 10 through 11. But the men, the angels, put forth their hand, pulled Lot into the house to them, and shut to the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. Lot had protected the angels and stood in their defense. So the angels protected Lot and they stood in his defense. Because God stands for them who stand for him. And it is amazing to see how God protects those who stand for him and his truth. As I reread this book by Chuck McElhaney and saw how God protected him through the years. His house was firebombed. He barely got out with his wife and kids. His car was smashed. Received threatening phone calls constantly with reference to his children and what was going to happen to them. His church was spray painted with graffiti. All because he went down to City Hall and testified against domestic rights ordinances. I think of Lon Maybon in Oregon, who has gone to jail, who has been shot at, who's lost his home, who has suffered innumerable threats and assaults. And yet, these men have been protected by God. And we need more men with backbone. Men who will stand up and fight the culture wars for Christ without fearing what it might cost them. We need those who will be fearless in fighting the evil in our society. And those who are can expect that God will send his angels to protect them. But note well, even though these homosexual rapists have been blinded by God, verse 11, they still are seeking to find the door and carry out their sin, even when the judgment of God is obviously upon them. You would think they would say, when they went blind, uh-oh, we'd better repent. God's hand is upon us. Perhaps if we do, our sight might be restored. But they are so enslaved to their lust that they would rather have homosexuality without sight than to forsake homosexuality and have it. Their sin is more precious to them than their eyesight. And the loss of their eyesight doesn't slow them down one bit from still trying to carry out their intended design. And so it is today. God has smitten the homosexual community with AIDS. Has that slowed them down one bit? It has only enraged them and caused them to drive even harder for their sin. Because they love their sin more than they even love life itself. And they will forsake not only eyesight, but life before they will forsake their sin. And that is why this is truly a suicidal death style. The average age of a homosexual male is 42 years. That's his average life expectancy of those who die not by AIDS. Those who die by AIDS, the average life expectancy is about 38 years. Whereas the average lifespan of the normal male that's married, 75 years. Now, our government's all up in arms about tobacco. Bad for your health. Gives you lung cancer. Might cut 10 years off your life. Drugs? No. Fries your brain? Don't want anything to do with that. Listen, I know an awful lot of tobacco smokers that are a lot older than homosexuals. And you would think that if our government were genuinely concerned about the health of our young people, they would have anti-homosexual campaigns in the public schools, just like they have anti-smoking campaigns in the public schools, instead of having pro-homosexual campaigns in the public school. Imagine if a public school says, well, this week we're going to have a honor smoking week. Why? They'd lose every ounce of government funding they ever had, and the parents would come and close the school. But they can have a gay pride week and get funding for it from the government to introduce children into this death style so that they can have 30 years knocked off of their lifespan, not just the 10 or 12 that smoking knocks off. And so, the Bible says in Proverbs chapter 8, God speaking there, all they that hate me love death. And when a people don't serve the Lord, they go away from life and they go towards death. The whole abortion movement is a culture of death. The whole homosexual movement is a culture of death. And when death comes as a result of these things, rather than give them up, they would rather have death. But notice how this attitude of love for sin, more than even love for life, had even infected Lot to some degree. Even he is reluctant to forsake family and fortune in order to flee from the wrath to come. Notice verses 15 and 16. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened to Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are all here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of this city. And I would submit to you, he was virtually consumed in it already. Verse 16. And while he lingered. Imagine lingering in the face of such a warning by such beings who by now he clearly understood who these folks were. I mean, it's not your average traveler on a camel that can go around smiting people with blindness. I think by now he had it figured out. Indeed, the text specifically says in verse 18, then the angels hastened Lot. So he knew who they were. And they warned him. And they have already said to them, verse 13, we will destroy this place because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And even in the face of all of that warning and all of that message, what does Lot do? He lingers. And then in verses 17 through 20, it says, it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad, they had to grab them by the hands and drag them out. They said, escape for thy life. Look not behind thee. Neither stay thou in the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And Lot said to them, no, wait a second. I don't like that plan. I don't want to go to the mountain. I want to go to this city over here. Behold now, verse 19. Thy servant has found grace in thy sight. Thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed to me in saving my life. I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Now pray tell, What greater evil could there be that could take him than that which he had just been delivered from the night before? And if the angels can deliver him from a raging homosexual rapist mob who is determined to kill him, does he not think God can take care of him in the mountains? Where there might be a few cougars and lions and bears, but they're nothing compared to the homosexual community. And this shows how a worldly and materialistic attitude had infected him and so dulled his sense of the fear of God and of the need for the preservation of his own life, that he was willing to linger and he was willing to argue and he did not want to leave behind these wicked cities. And he said, well, yeah, I'll leave this one, but I do want to go over into that one. If he could but remember the protection of the angels in the city and reflect on that, then surely he would think they would protect him in the mountains. And so we see indeed, as it says in 1 Peter 5, the righteous scarcely are saved because of their own stupidity. Where shall the wicked and the ungodly be? But nevertheless, in spite of his folly, Lot was protected, Lot was delivered. As it says, verse 16, the Lord being merciful unto him. The hope in all of this is that Lot was protected, even in spite of the dullness of his spirituality. But notice, secondly, that not only was Lot protected, notice the indifferent were lost. The indifferent were lost. Now, the indifferent, of course, are Lot's sons and his sons-in-law and his daughters who were married. It says, verse 14, Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked to his sons-in-laws. And pray tell, how could his son-in-laws ever take him seriously when he had lived such a compromised life himself? And then, of course, in verse 26, but Lot's wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And what we see is that Lot's wife and Lot's children were so desensitized to sin that they still wanted to stay in that city even after the events of the previous night. Can you imagine? After something like that occurred outside of your house, you saying to yourself, man, I don't want to leave this place. I like it too much. And it just goes to show the insanity that sin works upon the mind. That you would rather run those kind of risks than the risk of living up in the hills, where all you've got is trees and rocks and a few wild animals. And so Lot was protected, the indifferent were lost. Thirdly, notice the wicked were destroyed. Verses 24 through 25. But then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. Now, what exactly this conflagration is, no one knows for sure. Perhaps it was just a straight miracle where God just rained down brimstone and fire out of heaven. We know that there were asphalt pits all over this area because the king of Sodom and Gomorrah got tangled up in them back in chapter 14 when they had their little war with the kings of the east who came to conquer the cities. And so with all these asphalt pits, and there's a great earthquake fault there, and perhaps natural gas under the ground, maybe there was a bit of an earthquake with a lightning storm and it just lit it up, because the implication in the text is that the ground burned. And if there were coal deposits there, or if there were, as is more likely, oil or tar deposits there, and these caught on fire, and there were explosions where this stuff went up in the air and rained back down, this is how it could have occurred, certainly with God's supervision, but in a naturalistic explanation, or God could have just done a miracle. Either way, it doesn't matter. What matters is that it happened. And the result was, is that this whole area was burned, not only the cities, but the ground as well. And it was so destroyed that it sank. And the Red Sea, pardon me, the Dead Sea, then entered that area. And if you look at the Dead Sea on a map, you'll see that the northern part of it is large, and it's about 1,400 feet deep. Whereas the southern part, there's a narrow isthmus, and then there's a southern part of the Dead Sea. It's almost like a separate little lake. It's about 8 to 10 feet deep. And you can, in many places, wade across it. And this is the area it's believed that Sodom and Gomorrah was, and that because of the burning of the ground, there was a subsiding of the ground, and then the Dead Sea flowed into that area. And, of course, because of the burning, all the soil was destroyed, and what was before a verdant area turned into an absolute moonscape wasteland. Well, perhaps now you understand a little bit about why I've been involved with OCA for the last 10 years that I've been here in Oregon, and why I worked hard on the first measure 9, and the second measure 13, and the third measure 9, and why I was the statewide coordinator for the pastor's committee in favor of measure 9 this last time. It's because I recognize that this is where we're headed if we don't put a stop to it. And I know that this whole subject is revolting. It makes you sick to your stomach. You don't even want to think about it or talk about it. And I remember talking to one woman up in Sweet Home when the first Measure 9 came through in 1992, and she says, "I don't want to even think about this or deal with it." And I said, "If you don't think about it and deal with it now, these people in the next 5 years are going to be in your face. And then you won't be able to not think about it and deal with it." And those of you who are older know that 30 years ago, people didn't even utter the word. And now it's all over the news. And someone like Chuck Schumer is sitting up there in the United States Senate quizzing our Attorney General John Ashcroft about how he's going to take care of the gays in the Justice Department and all the privileges that he's going to extend to him. And how anyone could ever advocate such a revolting, disgusting, unhealthy, and destructive lifestyle as this is utterly beyond me, unless they are utterly depraved themselves. People will accuse me of gay bashing because of this sermon and being filled with hate and preaching hate, and hate is not a family value. I want to tell you what I preached tonight is the most loving thing I could have said to the homosexual community. Because unless these people repent of this lifestyle and forsake it, which they are all capable of doing by the grace of God, because it is not genetically programmed, they are all doomed to the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah, and not just for a few hours or days, but for all eternity. And so, if we would love homosexuals into the kingdom of God, we must not give them an inch of justification or quarter for what they do and what they are. We must have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather we must reprove them. And it's in the reproving of them that God perhaps would open their eyes to their own wickedness and bring them to repentance and faith in Jesus Christ. Am I saying I'm better than the homosexuals? I am not. But for the grace of God, I could be one of them. How does someone get there after all? As we read in Romans chapter 1 this morning, God gave them over to it. And it is His judgment upon a people who deny Him and His truth and His word. We see that rampant in our nation, where God is being tossed out of every institution and sphere of public life. And what is the result? Rampant immorality is breaking out, just like Romans 1 said it would. when they do not like to retain God in their knowledge and they exchange the truth of God for a lie, what happens? Homosexuality and all of its attendant vices break out. Romans 1. There's no mystery to it. And so that's why the gospel is the only remedy for it. We cannot fight this thing purely with medical facts or with health statistics or with the psychological damage that it does to those who participate in it. We have to deal with it with the gospel, because the gospel alone is the power of God to salvation to everyone that believeth, including the homosexuals. They can and may and must be saved if they would ever be people who would experience and taste the blessedness of both physical and eternal life. And so I would encourage all of you to be vigilant, to be outspoken, and to stand in every way you can against the furtherance of this vice, especially in the legal system in our land. Because if we don't, they're going to show up on our doorsteps, and they're going to show up with the police